roll.
Mr. Anderson?
Here.
Ms. Blair? Dr. Olson?
Here.
Mr. Strawn?
Here.
Ms. Warren?
Here.
And Chair Kanchoo?
Here. We have a quorum. At this moment, we'll open the public forum. Any member of the public may address or ask questions of the board relating to any matter within the San Diego Regional Board's jurisdiction, provided that matter is not on the agenda or pending before our water board. Do we have any public forum members today? None. Oh, we're moving expeditiously here. So our first order of business is to adopt our meeting minutes of May the 11th. Do we have a motion to do so as presented?
I move that we adopt the minutes from the May meeting.
I'll second that.
Thank you. Any questions, comments? Those in favor signify by saying aye. Roll call. Do we need a roll call on that? Would you please call the roll?
Aye.
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 Ms. Warren.
Aye.
And Chair Kanchoo.
Aye. Motion carries. Well, we are on item number two now, chairs, board members, and state board liaison and executive officers report. Do we have our state board representative, Nicole Morgan, via Zoom? Can we invite her to our meeting now?
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Hi, so let's see here. A lot going on as usual, and on May 24th, the State Board adopted an emergency water conservation regulation. The new regulation bans irrigating turf and commercial, industrial, and institutional properties such as grass in front of or next to large institutional or commercial buildings. The ban does not include watering the turf that is used for recreation or other community purposes, water used for residences, or water to maintain trees. The emergency regulation is expected to take effect in mid-June, depending upon the Office of Administrative Law processes. There is a new FAQ that was just posted on the State Board's webpage, I believe just on Monday. And so that is moving through. So stay tuned for additional updates on that emergency regulation as it takes place and begins to be implemented. So yesterday we had our state board meeting, and we had a hydrology and urban conservation update. As we are aware, and I've been reporting, January, February, and March have the least rainfall and snow on record of any of these months in history in California in the past 100 years. Statewide residential use for April of 2022 was 83 gallons per person per day, which is among the highest statewide averages observed since data collection began. And April 2022, so just this past April, there was a 17.6% increase in savings relative to April 2020. The cumulative use is still dropping, so that's disappointing to see. On July 2021 through April 2022, the cumulative savings was just 2% relative to 2020. So that's far from the governor's call for a 15% savings. April, only 2 out of 10 regions decreased in their overall use. That was the North Coast that had 14% savings, and North Lahontan, which had a 9.9% savings. Tulare Lake, Central Coast, South Lahontan, Colorado River, and South Coast regions also significant increases. The State Board is working with water districts on how to accelerate water use reporting and how to get more timely water use data, so that way we're not reporting this data, a couple of months, after after the fact. And so the Delta, the State Board will provide weekly updates on curtailment statuses. In mid-June, staff will release an updated water availability methodology and revised emergency regulation text for public comment. We will be reconsidering the readoption of the emergency regulation at our July 20th State Board meeting. The drinking water needs assessment, staff released the second annual drinking water needs assessment in May. Access to the full 2022 needs assessment report is on the State Board's website. And we have a new dashboard that is also on our website, which gives a lot of great data, and it's really easy to use, and really it's increasing that transparency to see what is happening throughout the state. The main revise, the governor released it on May 13th, which included resources to address immediate drought needs and build climate resiliency, water supplies. Highlights include providing grants to urban water districts and smaller community water suppliers for drought relief projects, supporting local technical assistance, emergency drinking water response, advancing drinking water and clean water projects that leverage significant federal infrastructure funds, enhancing water rights enforcement, and modernization tools. The proposal is currently being evaluated by the legislature. We ask that moves through. We will see what happens there. I believe, the legislature has until mid-June to consider and to adopt it so that we have the new budget in July, so next month. With that concludes my report for this month, and I am available if there are any questions.
Thank you, Board Member Morgan. Do we have any questions for? Yes, we do. Dr. Olson.
Hi. I just wanted to ask one quick question. Are there any plans to, we've had many efficiency steps in the past, and in looking, the one I saw that maybe could have the most bang for the buck that probably people haven't invested in is are washing machines, because they're the highest water user, one of the highest water users in the house, and they do have new 8-gallon washing machines. They cost about $3,000. And so that would be something that maybe looking at a subsidy for the public would be very useful.
Thank you for that comment. I definitely will note that. All comments are welcome around that. We really are looking for, things to make the long-term change. As we are in it, we understand, while we're in a drought now, we really are looking for changes for that can have that long-term impact, because we are in the midst of, climate change. And we're looking to make, we say conservation as a way of life. And so we have to make investments now in order to help with the future as the climate does change. And we do have, more drought, and just, this is our reality here in California. So thank you so much for that comment. I definitely will make a note of that and raise that up.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Any other questions for our State Board Representative? I really appreciated your report, particularly on the water conservation. I was really struck by 83 gallons. I hadn't seen that. I need to visit that portal more often. 83 gallons per person is, I think, a higher standard or higher use than we see anywhere in the world. 55 was considered what we were shooting for during the last drought. And so 83 is a lot higher than 55. In looking at where we could really save without changing our lifestyles, so to speak, is most people spend at least 50% of their total water budget outside their home. So wash machine is a big user. And so we all need to be careful about making sure we have full loads. But the main area that we can really focus on is what we use outside the home. So generally coastal areas is around 50%, smaller yards, not as hot, but inland areas is up to 80% of the water budget being used on their yards. So that's where we really need to landscape as if we lived in California, which is an ambition that I think is not too high. And I really encourage everybody to get to know their yards and learn a little bit about being a professional landscaper, because that's what we all have to be. We all have that obligation because water is so scarce and becoming scarcer, as we can see from all of our reports. Thank you very much, Board Member Morgan. We look forward to seeing you. You're coming down here now on, the date is, remind me, June later?
July 21st.
Yes.
Sometime soon in June. And we're really looking forward to spending some time with you then.
Thanks. Yes, I am definitely looking forward to that visit. And yes, it is now a little bit later. July 21st is now.
Oh, it's July 21st. Okay. There's a whole nother month to wait out before we get there. Well, we look forward to that.
Yes. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. Other board member reports and updates since we last met. Strong.
I don't want to steal Dave's thunder if he's got it in his executive officer's report. Was it last week? Dave and I went out to the groundbreaking ceremony at the East County Advanced Water Treatment Facility there at Sandy Lakes. Joaquin was supposed to come join us, but he was exposed to some virus that he didn't want to get on an airplane with. Dave did the speech for him and did very well and got to shovel some dirt. So I got a close-up picture. I think I sent it to you. I'll get it to the rest of the board if you want to have evidence that Dave's out there getting dirty. But it's a really big deal, I think. Their goal is to provide 30% of the water needed in East County through that one facility. And, you know, that's a lot of water. And it's a big difference in what we have to import, and you know, it gives us local control. It's not cheap, but it's not as expensive as diesel. So it's a good thing, and I think the city of San Diego is right close on their heels. And so it was fun to go out there and see everybody excited about that, starting to build that facility. They've had the smaller test facility going for, 6-7 years, I think. So they're ready to build the real thing now. So moving in the right direction.
Well, that's good news. Anyone else? Okay, I'll report that on May 20th, the chairs met, and vice chairs were invited. I was joined by our vice chair, Dr. Olson, in Sacramento to talk about the state of everything. And I guess the big takeaway I have is the State Water Board has a tremendous, unprecedented amount of money to move out into the communities to help people achieve a huge variety of things. A lot of them are SRF, the State Revolving Fund, which we're all familiar with. That's going to go far to help both in clean water and wastewater. My only concern is staff has not been increased proportionately to the amount of money that is going to have to be pushed out. And there is a lot of pressure, of course, because it's needed to push it out in a very quick fashion. So not only do we need the infrastructure it's going to engender, but we also need the economic development stimulus that it will bring along with it. So that's really good news. So if anybody has any ideas for projects that are ready to go, make sure you let all communities know of this money, because we would hate for us not to get our fair share down here in our region. So that's something that we have to really look forward to. Hopefully this money will be spent in a way that really moves us into a 21st century way of managing our water resources, not solving a single individual program or problem, but rather integrated, multi-benefit, multi-use investment that can clean water and save water and protect fish and probably create recreation and do a multiplicity of things. That's really the standard we're looking for to move us into the 21st century. So I was very excited about hearing about that. And all of that's on the website, so anybody who is interested can go and get more information. At this point, we'll ask if there's any questions for our executive officer. He had a very good and thorough report. Any questions for him?
It's not a question. I just want to say thank you. And thank you, Christina, for the explanation on the artwork that is now in the board meeting room. I was wondering after our last meeting, and I think it looks great. So if you can just pass along our thanks as well. This is the first time we get to publicly acknowledge the folks who did the work on it. It's awesome. Thank you.
And I think we will have a little bit of a presentation for the public and all of us a little bit later on this agenda, right?
Yeah, just in a few moments.
So that's wonderful.
Well, good morning, Chair Cantu and members of the board. Just a couple of things to add to the written report. I'd first of all like to ask you to join me in welcoming Sasha Smirinsky to a new role in our office, the site cleanup program, and to also welcome a new water resource control engineer, Masa Zadmer, to our groundwater sustainability and protection unit. Very happy to have her join us. Gary Strawn reported out on the East County Advanced Water Purification Project. We've been in communication with them and expect to have their report of waste discharge for their discharge aspect of that permit later this year. They're hoping to beat the city of San Diego to actually getting water into the reservoir. The city got its permit first, but East County is catching up very quickly. I was pleased to represent the board at the Industrial Environmental Association conference last week, where Reagan Morey, our water resource control, and I presented on stormwater and on the Tijuana River Valley, and I also gave a boat tour. Unfortunately, the audio and visual system would not allow recording of that, but I do have the presentation ready to go in my head. And I have asked for our staff to get our boat back into gear again. And I'm anticipating taking board members out in groups of two or three later this summer for that same tour and just an update on issues in San Diego Bay in anticipation of our August board meeting item on San Diego Bay. I was also pleased to meet with, by invitation with Commissioner Hanar of the International Boundary and Water Commission to talk about Minute 320 and then participate in a town hall with her and other local elected officials and representatives. We had two, I think, very good discussions that afternoon. And if there are no questions on those or other matters, I would like to turn the podium over to Christina Arias of our staff to talk with us about the artwork that was provided to our boardroom and dedicated.
Thank you, Ms. Arias.
Good morning. Can everyone hear me? That's better. Good morning, board members. My name is Christina Arias. I'm a water resources control engineer here at the Water Board. I've been here about 20 years, and my current assignment is with the Compliance Assurance Unit. But today I'm speaking to you as a proud parent of one of our young artists here. Yes, this art piece was completed by fifth graders that went to Kumeyaay Elementary School in Tirasana 2 years ago. So they're in middle school now. We were about to get ready to present the artwork, but then we had pandemic-related closures and so forth. So this is very exciting to me to be able to finally present to you the work that the students did. So just a little bit about it. So gosh, I feel like we came up with this idea several years ago. So with Dave's support, I approached the art teacher at school. Her name is Kathleen Kane Morell. She's a local artist and she runs this wonderful program. But every year the fifth graders do a comprehensive project. And I asked her, I said, can we please do a project that honors the Water Board's mission for clean water? And we aim for fishable, swimmable waters. And she said, absolutely. And I made it very clear, we need lots of color because our boardroom needs a lot of color. And the kids were very delighted and pleased to donate it for public display. So we're very happy and grateful for their efforts. And I just also wanted just to say a quick note about this program. It's called the Fine Artist Program. And I think it's actually been in San Diego for almost 30 years, but it is just fantastic. It's magnificent. And the reason why I think it's so sophisticated is because it's not just here's some art supplies and draw a picture of your pet or something. I mean, these kids, it's grade level specific, the lesson plans, but they visualize or they're exposed to a famous piece of art And then they come back and talk about it. They learn about the artists and a little bit about the history of the world at that time. And then they learn techniques. They replicate it in the classroom and they learn different techniques in media, whether it's watercolors or pastels and so forth. And so I think that they really get a lot out of it. And I would have to say that my only regret is that the school districts don't fund this program. And so us parents, we have to spend a lot of volunteer hours to raise the money for this program and the other enrichment courses like music. And so anyways, I just wanted to point that out because in here in my office, I think there's a lot of young families, babies being born and they're toddlers now. And so if my colleagues are listening, I just want to advocate that if you want to get art into your classroom to be really involved in the school. So if anyone has any questions about the fine artist program or I'm really good at fundraising at school. That's my side job. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yes.
We really enjoy this. And it's such a wonderful project because we're engendering good stewards.
Yes.
By creating, you know, developing their artistic abilities. And I think that's fantastic. So thank you for your leadership on this project.
All right.
Thank and you so much. Your superpower of fundraising.
Yeah.
Thank you, Christine. I hope you can stick around for a little while after the board meeting. We'd like to do some photos with the board members. Thank you. With that, that concludes my report.
Dave, can I just ask a follow-up question?
Sure.
On the two town hall meetings, presumably on the Tijuana River Flows, how well attended were they? And were they in person, Zoom, combination?
They were in person and they were by invitation. And so they, we saw representatives from all each of our congressional offices. Mayor Dedina was there. There were representatives from the County of San Diego and the City of San Diego and City of Chula Vista were also represented.
And at the risk of embarrassing our executive officer, I'd like to say I attended the first work session and everybody in the room looked to him for recommendations, ideas, for solutions as a resource. And it made me very proud, and not for the first time, but I thought it was very effective. And what came out of that, I thought was very good. They're kind of regendering this whole idea of a working group that will be comprised of people on this side of the border and also people on the Mexican side of the border. So a work group that can really envision projects that are coordinated and funded and successful. So it's will go far to hardwire our solutions that we're looking for on for our cross-border pollution flows.
I do remember, I do have one more thing to add. I have been given the green light to ask the County of San Diego to submit a package of full proposals for the Senate Bill 170 projects from the U.S. side, from the Tijuana Recovery Team, and the county's Senate Bill or 507 Needs and Opportunities Assessment Report. It also draws from our discussions with IBWC and Partners in Mexico on the three work groups, water quality, sediment, and trash. So we're not proposing projects out of thin air, but projects that have roots and discussions going back 12 years. I believe the State Board is anticipating taking action on those proposals in mid-July, probably just before Board Member Morgan is able to join us on the tour.
Good news. Thank you. Our next action item is consideration of a plume tracking monitoring program work plan for the Oceanside Ocean Outfall, the OOO, pursuant to order numbers Regional Board 9/2019-0166 and 0167 and 0169. And Mr. Yeager will start our overview. Thank you.
All right. Good morning, board members. I'm Keith Yeager, an environmental scientist with the San Diego Water Board. I don't know if we need to take an oath today.
Direction from our trusty attorney.
I don't think it's necessary, but we can do one.
Would you raise your right hand, everyone who is planning on presenting? Is that everybody? Do you all agree to tell the truth?
I do.
Thank you.
Also here with me today is Brandy Outwin-Beals, Senior Water Resource Control Engineer. She's on the Zoom meeting. Today, I will give a brief introduction on item 3 on today's agenda, the plume tracking monitoring program work plan for the Oceanside Ocean Outfall. After my brief introduction, I will hand the presentation to Dr. Michael Welsh, a consultant working on the project for the City of Oceanside, Fallbrook Public Utility District, and the Marine Corps Base Camp Pendleton. Okay, next slide. The controller is not working. All right, here's an overview of my presentation. I'll provide a brief discussion on the purpose of the item, the requirements of the plume tracking monitoring program work plan, and a discussion of the next steps. Next slide. The NPDES permit for the City of Oceanside, Fallbrook Public Utility District, and the United States Marine Corps Corps Base Camp Pendleton require the development of a plume tracking monitoring program. Briefly, the plume tracking monitoring program is used to determine the dispersion and fate of the wastewater plume discharged to the Oceanside Ocean Outfall. This is important for properly locating monitoring stations to measure compliance with water quality objectives. The plume tracking monitoring program will also evaluate plume behavior under different oceanographic conditions, which is important to assess whether the plume may encroach on recreational areas, particularly under atypical conditions, which are not currently well studied. Understanding the plume behavior under typical and atypical conditions could also lead to a more adaptive event-based monitoring program. Overall, the plume tracking monitoring program is consistent with the San Diego Water Board's practical vision in the monitoring framework and the Southern California Coastal Water Research Project monitoring recommendations for small POTWs in the San Diego region. The development of the plume tracking monitoring program is guided by a series of work plans. Consistent with your direction, the agencies must present their plume tracking monitoring program work plan for your approval. Next slide. The NPDES permits require the work plan include a conceptual site model, a description of the monitoring questions the study will evaluate, an evaluation of available plume tracking technologies, an approach for conducting a feasibility analysis to select the technology, and a schedule for submitting the plume tracking monitoring program. The work plan does not determine what plume tracking technology will be used. Next slide. If the work plan is accepted by the board, the discharges will proceed with the development of the monitoring program, which will include a selection of the technology, development of a sampling plan, and a schedule for completing the study. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Dr. Michael Welsh to discuss the plume tracking monitoring program work plan for the Oceanside Ocean Outfall.
Madam Chair, members of the board, my name is Mike Welch. I'm here to present today the work plan for the development of a plume tracking monitoring plan for the Oceanside Ocean Outfall. As Keith indicated, this is being submitted by the City of Oceanside, which is the operating agency of the Oceanside Ocean Outfall, in conjunction with their two prime discharge partners, U.S. Marine Corps Base Camp Pendleton and Fallbrook Public Utility District. By the way, last Sunday, the Fallbrook Public Utility District just celebrated their centennial, so congratulations to them on 100 years of service to Fallbrook. By the way, we're only a couple of years away from this board reaching its 75th birthday, if you can believe that. So that's a little statistic which makes us all feel old. Next slide, please. Next slide, please. As Keith indicated, Oceanside, Fallbrook, and the Marine Corps Base Camp Pendleton are required to submit this work plan to you, and they have done so in conformance with the NPDES permits listed on the slide. Next slide, please. Next slide, please. And as Keith indicated, there's two real functions of this overall plume tracking monitoring plan. The first is to provide additional information on how the outfall is performing, what's happening after the discharge occurs. Secondly, are we properly monitoring what's going on? Are there other monitoring parameters or other discharge locations that might give us better bang for the buck for our monitoring dollar? Next slide, please. At the encouragement of your staff, all of the regional agencies have coordinated in developing respective plume tracking monitoring plans. This started in 2015 with the City of San Diego and your Point Loma permit requiring them to implement such a plan, which they have implemented. In fact, they have incorporated that into their annual monitoring. The five northern smaller outfalls, San Alijo, Encina, Oceanside, San Juan Creek, and Aliso Creek outfalls, are in the process of developing plume tracking monitoring plans. Your staff organized a series of workshops with these agencies to encourage the agencies to coordinate with each other. In accordance with that encouragement, the agencies got together and developed a unified approach. So what you will be seeing today for the Oceanside Ocean Outfall is a similar work plan to what's being implemented on all five north small outfalls. Next slide, please. And there's a reason that this makes sense, because all of the five northern outfalls have very similar characteristics. Each discharge approximately a mile and a half to 2 miles offshore in waters 100 to 200 feet deep. Each involve relatively small discharges and also highly variable discharges, because each of these outfalls involve upstream agencies that implement a significant amount of recycled water use to where the flows during summertime in particular can be low. Next slide, please. Each of these outfall agencies are at a different stage in their plume tracking development work. Encina and San Alijo have essentially completed all of their work and will be presenting to you their analysis probably this fall for their completed work. The Oceanside Plume Tracking Monitoring Plan work plan is what we're discussing today. In February, you adopted permits for the South Orange County Wastewater Authority, Aliso Creek and San Juan Creek outfalls. They'll be in the process of developing work plans for their outfalls in the ensuing months. Next slide, please. As Keith indicated, there are several key elements that your NPDES permits require that these work plans address. First is a concept model, which, think of it as a statement of what we know or what we think we know about existing discharge conditions. Second are monitoring questions, things that we don't know or we'd like to know better. Third is monitoring technologies. What type of technologies could we use to better understand what's going on in the ocean? And fifth, what's an approach for implementing and selecting those technologies? Next slide, please. First of these elements, concept model, I'd like to spend a few moments on. Next slide, please. Our concept model, our understanding what's going on with the Oceanside Ocean Outfall, is based on an absolute wealth of data. There are numerous studies in the Oceanside immediate area and up and down the coast that could be applied to the Oceanside Ocean Outfall. In addition, we have over 45 years of receiving water data in the outfall vicinity. Next slide, please. And those data are collected at a series of outfall stations that follow a pattern that's very similar to all of the five north small outfalls, meaning you have a series of stations that are located around the outfall to assess what's happening at the outfall. Reference stations are located up gradient and down gradient from the outfall. Shore stations, which assess what is happening on the shoreline. And what has been very, very helpful for all of our small outfalls is these near shore stations, which have shown over the years that what happens on the shore stays on the shore and what happens out here stays out here. They're a very good picket line, if you will, for confirming that shore activities don't influence offshore activities and vice versa. Next slide, please. There's three elements to the concept model to consider. The first is initial dilution, or the vertical movement of the plume. This is something that happens literally on the order of a few dozen seconds. So I'd like to talk about that now. Next slide, please. The ocean plan defines initial dilution in terms of dilution caused by two factors. First is the dilution caused by the momentum or velocity of the outfall discharge itself. Think of this as dilution similar to dilution caused by hot tub water jet. The second form of dilution that occurs is dilution that results as a result of the buoyancy of the wastewater plume rising, sort of like a hot air balloon in air. These two factors are the key determinations in initial dilution, and the ocean plan defines that an initial dilution ceases when the plume ceases to rise. Next slide, please. This is sort of a textbook version of what a discharge plume works or looks like. All of our small north outfalls actually discharge out of both sides of the pipe, and this is just showing one side. And incidentally, while this shows the discharge as a light blue color, I should point out that each of our five northern small ocean outfalls involve a very high degree of treatment, secondary treatment, and also excess tertiary treatment as well. So we have virtually no settleable material in these discharges at all, and low concentrations of total suspended solids, where the discharge water is clear. And so it's during certain oceanographic conditions, the clarity of the water we're discharging from these outfalls can be as clear or clearer than the water we're discharging into. So I've shown the color here just for demonstration purposes to show that the velocity of the discharge plume outward and the buoyant effects upward are the things that cause initial dilution. The initial dilution ceases, as the ocean plan states, when the plume no longer rises. And that is largely determined in the ocean environment by seasonal stratification conditions. Next slide, please. This is kind of a complex slide, but it is a profile view of the outfall showing the shore to the right, offshore to the left. It shows the location of the monitoring station, shore station, near shore, and offshore stations. It also shows that there are stratification conditions that start occurring each spring, where waters in the upper portion above a thermocline start warming into the low 60s Fahrenheit. They become separate from waters below the thermocline, which almost year-round stay at about the mid-50 temperature. Next slide, please. As waters heat up more in summer months, to the mid-60s to high-60s, the thermocline strengthens and deepens. We are discharging below the thermocline, so this essentially acts as a trapping or inversion layer that keeps our discharge below that. Next slide, please. By late summer, late fall, we reach conditions of maximum stratification where our discharge is confined to the greatest degree, meaning that the vertical profile in which our discharge can rise is limited. That's the time we see the worst case initial dilutions, when our discharge is trapped in those confining conditions. As we move into winter conditions, as conditions in the upper waters, the epilimpic, next slide, please. The thermocline becomes to weaken as waters in the upper part start falling into the mid and low 60s again, to the point, next slide. But there's often a couple week period where the thermocline disappears. Those of you familiar with limnology will recognize this exact same pattern occurs within our surface, deep surface reservoirs as well. We call this condition in the reservoirs, for example, spring turnover, meaning that during storm conditions, the agitation of winds and the like is sufficient to mix the water through the entire profile. Next slide, please. The NPDES permit for the Oceanside Ocean Outfall assigns an 87-to-1 initial dilution. And this, by definition of the ocean plan, is computed using several conservative assumptions. First, zero ocean currents. Second, maximum permitted monthly flows. And third, maximum stratification conditions. As I had presented earlier, however, the maximum stratification conditions typically occur in late fall, precisely the time when our recycled water demands are greatest and our outfall flows are less. So for these reasons, we believe that the 87-to-1 initial dilution that is established in the permits right now is a conservative value. Next slide, please. So we've talked about the vertical movement of water, which occurs literally on the order of dozens of seconds. Horizontal movement of the discharge is largely a factor of ocean currents. And because our discharge is almost always trapped below the thermocline, it's a function of ocean currents that occur at depth or mid-depth areas. Next slide, please. We have a wealth of information on ocean currents, and there are some interesting facts that we learn from looking at the ocean current studies at the Oceanside Ocean Outfall and nearby outfalls such as Encinas, San Alejo, and other areas. First is that net current movement is up coast and down coast. Secondly, that longshore currents, meaning the up coast, down coast currents, are highly correlated, meaning that a single current meter can kind of tell you what the net up coast, down coast movement is over a very large region, which is very valuable to know. Next slide, please. This is shown from a study Dr. Scott Jenkins, Scripps Emeritus Professor, did in 2013, immediately north, about a mile north of the outfall location, where they used acoustic Doppler current profile devices to assess currents. And these were net average, meaning that short-term fluctuations, onshore off movements and things like that were zeroed out. You can see the streamlines literally follow the ocean bottom contours. And again, this is something that we see up and down the coast at all five north small outfalls. Next slide, please. The other major issue that we find from looking at the ocean current data is that the cross-shore movements are short period, but highly variable. The other thing that's very interesting is studies that have looked at multiple current meters very close to each other has found that while there is high correlation between the up coast and down coast movement between various points where we're measuring it, there's very little correlation between monitoring locations for the cross shore component, meaning that if you have an ocean current meter, it gives you a good idea what the longshore movement is in that whole region, but it doesn't necessarily tell you what the cross-shore movement is anywhere. So that's kind of an important thing, as we'll see in a bit here. Next slide, please. We've talked about the movement of the discharge once discharged. I'd like to spend just a moment talking about the fate of discharge pollutants. Next slide, please. Because some of those pollutants disappear and others don't. And I would like to call your attention to the bottom line of this slide, which is the best line of defense, as we all know, to prevent any issues is to prevent stuff from going in the ocean in the first place. We recognize, however, that despite the best level of treatment, sometimes chemicals or constituents will. And that's really one of the focuses of our plume tracking monitoring plan, to kind of get a better handle on what happens to the water we discharge and what happens to the stuff that's in the discharge as well. Next slide, please. Again, just a few brief conclusions regarding our concept model. The principal ones here, the discharge remains trapped below the thermocline. Up coast and down coast movement dominates. Essentially, what is discharged offshore stays offshore, and what is discharged onshore stays onshore. This is something that most surfers recognize when you go in the water. The currents carry you up coast and down coast, maybe a mile. They never carry you 3 miles offshore. The other thing, the 87:1 initial dilution, we believe, is conservative. Next slide, please. The second required element of the plume tracking monitoring plan is monitoring questions, and your permits actually take care of that element for us. Next slide, please. By listing 7 questions that we should design our plume tracking monitoring program around. As Keith indicated, one of the principal ones is, are our monitoring locations and methods adequate? And what parameters are best suited for assessing our discharge? The last question is one that's particularly important to our dischargers too, is when is the discharge no longer distinguishable from ambient water? If we can identify that point, then that will allow us to better locate our monitoring to get better bang for the buck. Next slide, please. There's also 2 issues that we've added to the mix in our work plan. First is we would like to be able to better define where this dilution occurs in order to ensure that we have the proper monitoring station locations. Second, the fate of discharged bacteriological constituents is something that we would really like to explore. Next slide, please. The reason this is that the San Diego region is the only region in the Southern California Bight, and I believe the only region in the state, where through a historical quirk, which I can explain if you're interested during our question session, EPA has interpreted as applying beach standards to all marine waters regulated by the state in this region, meaning the standards that apply to the beaches also apply 3 miles offshore at a depth of 300 feet. Now, this is important because our ocean outfalls discharge offshore into these very waters. The ocean plan establishes both fecal coliform and enterococcus standards. For fecal, for example, there's a single sample maximum and geometric mean. For the enterococcus, there's a statistical threshold value, which is sort of the maximum type parameter, and a geometric mean. Just as an aside here, next slide, please. I'd like to point out that the single sample maximum and statistical value limits are of great importance because it's very, very, very difficult to exceed the geometric mean standards just because of the nature of how the geometric mean is computed. And I've thrown a few examples here for fecal coliform, showing that 80% of our samples could be at the single sample maximum limit, and we could still meet the 30-day geometric mean. We could have 60% of our samples 10 times the maximum limit and still meet that mean. We could have 40% of our samples 100 times the limit. So that's one of the reasons that we focused on looking at these single sample maximum limits or statistical threshold values as opposed to these geometric means, because you really have to have a lot of poor quality water consistently. That just doesn't occur at any of our five northern small outfalls, where the median coliform and enterococcus value is less than 2. The statistical mode, meaning the most common value found, is also less than 2. We really only need to hit one or two of those a month at any location, and we easily comply with the geometric mean standards. Next slide, please. I'd previously identified we have several stations immediately surrounding the ocean outfall discharge stations A1 through A4 here, and the next slide shows these kind of blown up. And we look at, next slide, please. And we look at data from 2018 to 2020 for fecal coliform and enterococcus. We see that 0% of our enterococcus samples at mid-depth exceeded the statistical threshold value during this period. And we have a few exceedances of fecal coliform. Given that these stations are so close to the outfall and that the outfall discharge is only partially disinfected, I personally would expect these values to be much higher. And so one of the questions that we'd like to look at as part of the plume tracking plan is, are these stations adequately located? Should we shift them around? Are we missing something here, or is something happening such as die-off or inactivation of enterococcus and fecal coliform before it gets to our station? Or are they located so close that we need to move them off a little to allow the plume to spread out a little more to find out what's going on? So the anomalies associated with these numbers sort of let us understand that we really need to look a little closer into this, and we can use the plume tracking program as a means of helping address why this occurs. Next slide, please. The third part of our plume tracking monitoring plan work plan is a technology feasibility evaluation. Keith, next slide, please. Keith, next slide. Yeah. The NPDES permit requires us to assess two technologies shown in red here, something called permanent real-time oceanographic mooring systems, which are systems that are moored and measure ocean currents and density conditions and radio that back to land in real time, and something called advanced monitoring technologies, such as autonomous underwater vehicles or AUVs or towed vehicles. As part of our work plan, we also looked at dive tracers, modeling, remote sensing and physical tracking, just to be complete. And you'll see that if you go through the work plan, that we've gone beyond just the two technologies that are listed in the NPDES permit. The NPDES permit also says the work plan has to list the advantages, disadvantages, costs, and effectiveness of each. Next slide, please. With respect to real-time oceanographic mooring systems, two principal takes from this is, one, they're difficult to maintain and keep operable, as Steve San Diego is finding out with its system here. High implementation cost, and it doesn't necessarily tell us a lot that we don't already know. Next slide, please. The use of the autonomous underwater vehicles
also has high cost and disadvantage that it only assesses conditions when they're out there operating. But it does give us an ability to address a lot of the questions that are part of the NPDES permit. Next slide, please. Next slide. In fact, we believe that if you combine the autonomous underwater vehicle monitoring with a grid-based receiving water quality monitoring, that'll provide us data to where we can address each of the seven questions in your NPDES permit, whereas the real-time ocean current monitoring won't allow us to do that. So while, as Keith indicated, the work plan is not for purposes of selecting the technology, we've already got an idea of where we want to head. As a matter of fact, we've already developed a draft plume tracking monitoring plan that incorporates the findings from this work plan. Next slide, please. As I'd indicated, the remote vehicle monitoring is expensive, but we're finding from the other outfalls that have implemented this right now, but there's a lot of intriguing results that are coming out of this. Some things that confirm what we knew all along, and some other findings that tell us something new. And again, as you hear the San Alijo and Encina results coming later this year, I think you'll be intrigued by what they're finding there. And again, combining it with boat-based monitoring allows us to provide kind of a multiple lines of evidence approach where we're not just relying on a single parameter to understand what's going on. Next slide, please. Just to give you a quick idea of what these things look like. The top is an typical underwater vehicle. These are programmable vehicles that essentially swim in the ocean at depths wherever you'd like to program them to swim. You combine that with CTD or conductivity temperature depth devices, which are lowered into the water and give you an idea of the vertical stratification and conditions within the water, and acoustic Doppler current profilers, which tell you what the currents are at each level there. So these three give you a good three-dimensional picture of exactly what's going on when you're out in the water. Next slide, please. Keith had indicated that he wants us to look at typical and atypical conditions. And in conjunction with your staff, we came up with a series of parameters that we would like to monitor and a series of autonomous underwater vehicle deployment schedules that we would like to propose. Key among here is something you probably recall from the City of San Diego presentation of their plume tracking monitoring, a parameter called CDOM, colored dissolved organic matter. Which is something that can be monitored with a sensor that can be handheld or mounted on an underwater vehicle. And while CDOM is something that exists in the ocean in various levels, it is possible to distinguish in certain circumstances the CDOM signature of the wastewater you're discharging versus the CDOM signature of the ambient water. And you can use that as a very valuable parameter to assessing the possible presence of your discharge. And when you combine that with temperature, salinity, pH, DO, and other parameters such as that, you can use a multiple line of evidence approach to confirm the presence of that discharge. Next slide, please. In conjunction with your staff, we've selected three types of deployments in order to assess the typical and atypical conditions addressed in your NPDES permits. First is late summer or fall conditions where we have maximum trapping depths. We expect initial dilution at that time to be lowest. Late winter and spring conditions, on the other hand, we typically will have high discharge flows. We might have minimum plume trapping conditions, but the highest anticipated height of rise for the plume, so it would be located over the greatest vertical profile. Staff had also requested we add one additional one, which is storm conditions. We could not actually assess storm conditions during the storms because of the safety of the boat crews, but we compromised and we decided to assess post-storm conditions when we're still having the influence of shore-based runoff. We still have wind mixing effects associated with storm conditions, and we have kind of unusual conditions that we really don't have a lot of information on now, and so the staff recommended that to us in order to look at this atypical condition that we currently don't know much about. Next slide, please. The last part of our work plan is an implementation schedule. Next slide, please. And the permit indicates that we have to complete all of our work and present a state of the ocean report, including our plume tracking findings, by September of 2024. We have a schedule in the work plan that we've submitted to you that allows us to do that. Additionally, the city is in a position to move forward very quickly on this. Lori Rigby of the City of Oceanside is with me right here, and she informs me that the city has already taken a look at the draft version of the plume tracking monitoring program that we have ready for submittal to your staff. Additionally, the city has contacted outside contractors who can do the type of remote sampling, the AUV deployments. So the city's prepared to move forward with this very, very quickly. And she is available to answer any questions on that, as well as any questions that you might have on some exciting developments within the city the last few years. Of course, you're familiar with their pure water program that has been implemented. They also have some planned wastewater changes in the future too. So she's here if you have any questions on that. Bottom line is, we can meet the schedule that's in your NPDES permit. We have a plan that we've developed with your staff that we think addresses the spirit and letter of the plume tracking monitoring plan requirements. Next slide, please. And at this time, I'll take any questions you have.
Thank you, Dr. Welch. Questions for Dr. Welch?
Thank you for the presentation and the submittal, like the pre-read that we had. I thought that was helpful. My question is, if you were here 5 years from now or 10 years from now, can you forecast for us what the different technologies you'd be evaluating might look like?
With respect to plume tracking? Probably the same. The reason being is that certain technologies that sound really nice and high tech, such as remote sensing, aerial or surveillance monitoring and the like, we just don't have any parameters right now that we can use, that we can sense from a distance and be all that useful, except in rare circumstances where there is some unusual discharge condition that typically just doesn't occur. So I don't know that we would be in a position to offer any new technologies other than the fact that the existing technologies, such as the AUVs, the autonomous underwater vehicles, are becoming better. The batteries are becoming better. They can go longer. So instead of having day deployments, we might be able to have week-long deployments. That might be something that is possible in the future. The other thing, too, is that, generally speaking, the monitoring techniques, the analysis techniques, really haven't changed a whole lot. When I was a student in college, I worked in a lab at USGS in Menlo Park as a part-time job, and a lot of the sample techniques I used 50 years ago are still in effect today. So from a standpoint of analysis, a lot of the same analysis methods will be used, but there will be probably in the future additional companies that come on board with devices that can give us a quick read without necessarily meeting the analytical standards to demonstrate compliance, at least might give us a quick lead. And it could be an instrument that could be mounted on an underwater vehicle such that we could assess additional parameters more than we can right now. For example, nitrate might be one such parameter. There are some sensors, if you will, that can look at that, but they're not particularly sensitive at looking at the concentrations that are in the ocean right now and in our discharge right now after dilution. Who knows, 10 years from now, those devices may become such that we can mount them on an AUV and fly that through our plume and have a profile not only of CDOM and salinity and temperature and everything, but of some of the water quality parameters that are regulated parameters. Did that address your question?
Just curiosity, the AUVs that you at least foresee using in the near future, how big are they?
They're pretty long.
You see the picture, but I can't tell if that's 6 feet or.
Yeah. You're not going to take them out in an outboard motorboat.
Okay.
These are.
So you need a big. And then that leads my second question. Are they totally programmable? You just drop them in the water and they go to where you pre-programmed to go? Or
there's two types that can be used. The types that have been used by Scripps and by the folks that have been helping us with the plume tracking work for the 5 small northern outfalls are using the AUVs, which is something they program. So what they do is they go out, they use the acoustic Doppler current profiles to tell whether the current is going up coast or down coast. then for that particular direction, they plan, they program a flight plan for the AUV, and it goes out, does it. It comes to the surface, and they download the data. The city of San Diego has gone to something called a remotely operated towed vehicle, where they literally drop something off the back of the boat, and then they can pull the boat around and fly that way. And they're using that as we speak to collect this type of information.
The third question I have is, 2 years ago, we got had the opportunity to take a tour of the Navy lab out on Point Loma that was doing a lot of work with remote sensors and things. Did you work with them regularly? They seem very willing to share their information and their technology. I know they were working on batteries a lot.
There's a lot of research going on there. And of course, some of that is research that's publicly available, and some of it is research that isn't. So we keep an eye on it. Typically what happens is the military develops a technology. And if there becomes a commercial application for that technology, independent companies will come along and develop that. And we'll be working with those types of companies rather than the military to implement that technology. In fact, the autonomous underwater vehicle themselves is an example of this. The military developed those long before they had commercial applications, and they were using them. Then scientists such as the Scripps folks figured, hey, we can use these and gather a lot of underwater data that we otherwise could not be able to collect.
Any other questions? Dr. Olson?
I wanted to ask about Landsat data looking at algal blooms, because I know it's been employed in a number of places and it seems quite successful. And I think that's one of the areas that people are concerned about, although they're cyanobacteria, not necessarily green.
Yeah, absolutely. Algae blooms and nutrients are, as you've heard from the SCORP presentations to you, are something that is of great significance. And incidentally, there was a SCORP technical advisory group meeting last Monday that had some interesting tidbits buried in their slides there that I thought were applicable to our small outfalls, the San Alejo, Encina, Oceanside, and the two Sakwa outfalls. And that's that from a mass emission basis, the small outfalls are, at least to my eye in their slides, was the smallest contributor of any of the sources to the Southern California Bight in terms of nutrients. Secondly, the other thing I gathered from those slides, which no one commented on, but I found significant, was the projected future mass emissions of nutrients from the San Diego region was shown as going down, whereas everywhere else within the Southern California Bight, it was shown as going up. It's probably attributable to the very large pure water programs and the recycled water programs and high degree of treatment that's proposed down here. So I think some of the work that this board is doing with respect to supporting pure water programs may be showing up in terms of minimizing potential impacts to such things as algal blooms. The other point to make with respect to algae, and you taught classes on this, I would invite you to offer opinions, but generally speaking, life operates pretty quickly, and it will uptake nutrients very quickly when you have nutrients and an energy source. It doesn't take years or months or weeks, it's on the order of hours and days. We're discharging small amount of nutrients out of our outfalls on a year-round basis. The only time we seem to see these algae blooms is during those periods where we have a lack of a thermocline, the spring conditions, and the upwelling events can bring nutrients from the depths. So that's something that some of the outfall agencies are very concerned about, because they feel that they may be, particularly the smaller dischargers, the north outfall dischargers, are concerned that they could be unfairly blamed for phenomena that have a much wider cause.
So I'm still wondering, I mean, you're not going, so looking at algal blooms due to their relationship with nutrients is not part of this.
That is not part of the work plan. No, this is a plume tracking work plan.
All right.
Now, to follow up your question, Dr. Olson, however, once we've identified better information on plume tracking, and when the plume is distinguishable as a plume, it may be that we can then better focus on some of these advanced remote sensing techniques, taking a look at algae blooms and the like, and determining if there's a correlation between them and discharges. Incidentally, the SQRP model folks from this phone call were mentioning that almost all the effects they're seeing are far offshore, not in the area we're discharging here. So the algae blooms that we see are often, at least the red tide events that we've seen the last few years, are often things that occur in shore waters more than in the waters immediately on top of the outfalls, who are located a couple miles offshore. But as more additional information comes forward on plume tracking and plume movement, that's something to look at. And I know your staff in the past has acquired satellite imagery and has looked for evidence of tie-ins between point and non-point sources and algae blooms.
The other question that I wanted to ask was about the fecal coliform and enterococci data that mm-hmm. you had collected. Now, I thought I saw that there were 4 out of 135 data points that were in the paper, and maybe I missed something, but you said there were 17% of violations over 400.
That was at a particular station at a particular depth. You may have been referring to some average values that were listed in the actual work plan itself, but the graphic I showed you here was one that looked at at a particular mid-depth point at a particular station.
So I didn't miss those data in the report. I looked at the overall data because I was, mm-hmm. you know, if you have 4 out of 135,
yeah,
it's not a common event.
Yes, but again, if I broke it down, and I don't recall, I have to look in the report to see if I broke it down that much in the report other than the little box diagrams I showed you there. But for the fecal coliform, there was a particular location at depth where we did see about 1 out of every 6 or 7 samples that hit that limit. And again, given the proximity of these monitoring points to the outfall where initial dilution has just immediately occurred, I would have expected those numbers to be higher. And that, again, that's one of the things we want to look into as part of this plume tracking study is what's going on here. Are we experiencing die-off? Are we just not having the locations at the right point? We're seeing this virtually at all of our outfalls. We have a number of the other small outfalls too, to where we're just not seeing what I would think would be the expected concentrations. A part of this is due to the fact that many of the outfalls have a very long diffuser and they have very low flow. So you're putting very little water into a very large very little amount of wastewater into a very large volume of water. And so the dilution you'd get there may be such that you just don't see any evidence of these bacteriological contaminants. The Oceanside outfall is a shorter diffuser, and mm-hmm. so it's a little more compact than the others. That may be why we're seeing a few hits with Oceanside that we're not necessarily seeing in others. Incidentally, the San Juan outfall does occasionally get a few hits as well, and it's kind of a similar depth. So those are the two outfalls.
It's a longer outfall
diffuser. But San Juan and Oceanside are the two where we occasionally get these. So the plume tracking programs hopefully will let us better understand if our monitoring locations are properly sited.
Also, I thought that the speed that the plume was spreading at was pretty fast. So
yeah.
it seemed like you could go like 80,000. I mean, this may be a wrong calculation because I just was kind of doing it. If it's 70 or 80,000. Centimeters, which is fair, you know, in an hour. So,
yeah, and when you add ocean currents into the mix, they can move around a lot. Now, the interesting thing is past current ocean current studies combined with modeling studies for outfalls that discharge at, say, about an 8,000 foot distance offshore, the plume is largely confined within an alley that's about 5,000 to 12,000 feet offshore for that type of discharge. And that's reasonably consistent. It's like 99% of the time it's there.
So is that because of the thermocline?
That's because the net current movement is up coast and down coast, and the short term cross shore movements mm-hmm. back and forth tend to cancel each other out. And so when
it just moves.
Things are kind of moving like this, but net mm-hmm. the net is is north or south, whereas the cross shore kind of mm-hmm. cancel each other out.
And that doesn't occur with these depth of outfalls.
Well, we see cross shore, these short-term cross shore motions at all depths.
Oh, at all depths.
At all depths, yeah. Even deep, at all depths, they found that a number of factors, including internal waves in the thermocline, can affect this. But if you look at all the ocean current data, I mean, the back and forth mm-hmm. stuff is, it's there all the time. Now, mm-hmm. it's kind of moving back and forth. It's not inching closer to the shore,
mm-hmm.
But it's kind of going back and forth a lot. And again, what is discharged offshore tends to stay offshore, and what's discharged onshore stays onshore because of this net parallel movement to the coast.
So there's sort of a region.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you for your presentation.
Any other questions for Dr. Welch? Thank you very much. At this time, I'll entertain a motion to approve the plume tracking monitoring program work Chair for the Oceanside.
Before we ask for a motion, can we check to make sure we don't have any speakers on Zoom
course.
Or in the room who wish to address the board?
Yes. Do we have any speakers who would like to address the board on this issue?
No speakers.
Okay. Thank you very much. We'll entertain a motion to approve the Oceanside Ocean Outfall pursuant to orders number Regional Board 9, 2019, 10166, 0167, and 0169.
I'll move approval.
I'll second.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
It has been moved and seconded. Will the clerk please call the roll?
Mr. Anderson?
Aye.
Dr. Olson?
Aye.
I'm sorry, Ms. Blair?
Yes.
Mr. Strawn?
Yes.
Ms. Warren?
Aye.
Chair Rakentu?
Aye. Motion carries. What's the pleasure of the board? Would you like a short 5-minute break at this point, or shall we? Okay, we'll take a 5-minute break. Thank you, and I apologize for our late start. Item number 4 is the administrative civil liability hearing, administrative civil liability complaint against Baldwin and Sons, Inc. et al., Portola Center South Construction Site, complaint Regional Board 9-2020-006. I have a statement to read here. Here we go. The San Diego Water Board held a public hearing on January 10th, 12th, and 13th, 2022, to hear evidence and comments on the allegations contained in civil liability, administrative civil liability complaint number Regional Board 9-2020-006. This is the time and place for the San Diego Water Board to consider tentative order number Regional Board 9-2022-0094. The board will not accept any written comments or new evidence in this matter. The parties will be allowed to make oral comments on the tentative order for 15 minutes each. Interested persons will be allowed 3 minutes for oral comments. For the order of the proceedings today, first we will hear from the prosecution team, and then the dischargers, and then interested persons. And lastly, the board members may ask questions of any comments received. At this time, we'll administer the oath to all persons intending to provide oral comments. If you are here in person or attending virtually via Zoom, please raise your right hand. And I assume I know we have some people in Zoom. I don't see any hands up. There we go. Some hands are up. Do you swear the comments you're about to give is the truth? If so, answer, I do.
I do.
And I suppose some people did on the Zoom. Yes, I see evidence of that now. You may lower your hands. Please state your name, whether or not you took the oath, before giving any oral comments. We'll start with the prosecution team's comments.
Good morning, board members. This is Julie Macedo on behalf of the prosecution team. I'll note that my co-counsel Naomi Rubin is on Zoom. We appreciate the opportunity to comment on the order, which we obviously found very thorough, and we appreciated both the advisory team and the board members' diligence in analyzing considerable evidence and testimony from all parties. We want to make sure that we remind the board and the regulated public that the administrative process is usually much more streamlined than this. The penalties in this matter took place in 2015 and 2016, and the hearing, as you said, was January of this year. That was a considerable amount of time, but to the extent that at any time we are willing to entertain reasonable settlements, reasonable resolutions of issues, and certainly assist dischargers coming into compliance, not just this particular group of dischargers, but any regulated entity that feels it has a question or is eventually subject to an enforcement matter. The very name of Ms. Clemente's unit is called the Compliance Assurance Unit, and not necessarily a penalty or a fine generating exercise. We note that the prosecution team strove to suggest a fair and defensible penalty and not the most aggressive penalty that we could. We selected enforcement policy factors consistent with the most recent stormwater case previously before you, which was San Altos. We appreciate that the Office of Enforcement has developed the expertise to handle the challenges that we did in this matter, both from the legal side and the technical side. And certainly the San Diego board staff showed great diligence in both verifying, confirming, and then presenting their positions. And we note that this order is going to be very significant in the construction industry, not only because of its significance, but also in the message to people with authority to control the violations and really prevent them. And certainly in everything that this board does, a fine won't necessarily prevent or alleviate the environmental harm that occurred, but simply dissuade the next future actor. And so we definitely hope that that is an expected outcome. As to arguments related to the tentative order, I don't have any. We appreciate the thoroughness, as I said. I would simply make a note of four typographical issues for clarification, two on the tentative order and two on attachment A. On the tentative order, on page 16 of 70, footnote 9, after the language "man affirmed that," we would suggest that there's a missing word. "Man affirmed that he was an employee." So add the word "he." On page 51 of 70, on the violation for January 8th, 2016, we would suggest adding PT Exhibit 425 at the end of that entry. This would be consistent with page 58 of 70 related to the January 8th, 26 violation, and simply provides a citation. As to attachment one, on page 37, we suggest that in the first paragraph, where it says at the conclusion of that paragraph, it says in the ACLC report, we suggest that it says the RINCON ACLC report for clarity. And finally, on page 45 of attachment A, near the bottom where it says November 2015 through March 2016, we believe the total base liability amount, instead of $16,025, it should be $116,025. So one has been omitted. That is all I have at this time. Unless there are questions, I would defer my time to respond to any arguments raised by defense counsel.
Thank you. So next we'll invite comments from the dischargers. Virtual comments or in-person comments.
Good morning, Madam Chair and board members. Nice to see you all again. As you know, my name is Stephen T. and I am a partner with the law firm of Gatsky, Dillon and Balance in Carlsbad, California. And along with Ms. Teal and Ms. Bone, we are again appearing on behalf of the dischargers this morning. I do have some comments. We've had an opportunity to review the tentative ACL order that was circulated via email on May 24th. And I want to first thank the board for providing us with at least a few minutes to address our concerns before the board considers taking action on the order. Preliminarily, I would note that it is really not feasible for us to address all of our concerns regarding the tentative order today, given the 15-minute time limitation. But given the instructions that written comments regarding the order were not permitted, we'll do our best to highlight our concerns today in the time allotted. I also want to make clear that many of our concerns regarding the tentative order involve issues and topics that have been addressed in prior briefing and correspondence with the advisory team and board, and even during the three-day hearing that was held in this matter. As a result, so to the extent I can only provide high-level comments or overview comments due to time constraints, the details and legal authority supporting many, if not most, of our concerns regarding the tentative ACL order can be found in our prior briefing, our correspondence with the advisory team, and the hearing transcripts from the hearing in January. I want to start by making it clear that the dischargers believe the board should not adopt the tentative ACL order today. As I will discuss in detail in a moment, the tentative ACL order is flawed, and the proposed civil liability amount is not supported by the available evidence, the administrative record, and legal authorities. As a result, adoption of the tentative ACL order in its current form will only result in further administrative proceedings and ultimately likely litigation in the courts. And the dischargers, my clients, do not desire that outcome. So with all that in mind, I'll briefly review the dischargers' specific concerns regarding the tentative ACL order. First, the tentative order is the result of a process in which the board deprived our clients, the dischargers, of both their right to a fair trial under applicable California law and also their due process rights as guaranteed by both the U.S. and California constitutions. This occurred in numerous respects throughout the process, and I'll highlight a few. First, the board did not provide adequate hearing time for this matter. Despite the dischargers' warnings, the 17 hours would be inadequate for the dischargers to present their entire case, including direct examination of dischargers' witnesses, cross-examination of the prosecution team witnesses, and opening and closing statements. The hearing showed that these warnings were well-founded. Despite the best efforts and diligence to manage time, the clock ran out on dischargers. Dischargers were unable to present testimony from all of their witnesses, including two individuals who now face potential personal liability in the amount of approximately $6.6 million. Second, there may be issues regarding a biased decision maker here. In reviewing the transcript from the hearing, board member Abarbanel made numerous comments that were interjected before a single witness had testified, showing a level of prejudgment and bias against the dischargers that is of great concern. The record from the hearing on January 12th supports these concerns. Also, while all of the members of the board attended the entirety of the prosecution team's presentation of evidence, the same is not true for the discharger's presentation. The transcript reflects that at least two of the board members failed to attend significant portions of discharger's presentation of evidence and closing argument. Further, the hearing transcript also reflects potential improper ex parte communications between a board member and the prosecution team that are of concern. The manner in which the board handled objections to testimony was also improper. During the hearing, the board did not allow for the interjection of objections during testimony, and the result was an awkward and not very useful process by which counsel was required to identify all objections to testimony after the testimony had occurred and after the board members had asked questions of the witness. Not surprisingly, the board overruled every single evidentiary objection made by dischargers' counsel to testimony proffered by the prosecution team. Finally, following the hearing, the board requested additional briefing on newly identified court decisions and legal theories, and then improperly refused to allow dischargers to submit rebuttal briefing addressing the prosecution team's arguments. And lastly, regarding this issue, the hearing procedures that were used for this are void as an underground regulation as a matter of law consistent with the Malaga decision. For all these reasons, the board has deprived the dischargers of their right to a fair trial and their due process rights. I'll move on to the second area of comment, and that is that the tentative ACL order improperly imposes liability against non-liable entities and individuals. First, the tentative order imposes liability on three of the named dischargers, Baldwin & Sons, Inc., Baldwin & Sons, LLC, and Sunrise Pacific Construction, based solely on a theory of liability that the tentative order labels as, quote, site operator, close quote, liability. The tentative order includes only a single paragraph citing legal authorities that purportedly support this theory of liability. However, the cited legal authorities are of no help to the board. Notably, none of the regional boards has ever imposed administrative civil liability based upon the so-called site operator theory of liability in prior cases. This is likely true because there is no such thing as site operator liability. It appears to us that the tentative ACL order in its zeal to impose liability on as many companies and people as possible is trailblazing a new path of liability. Unfortunately, it is one lacking a proper legal footing. Also, the tentative ACL order imposes liability on three individuals, namely Jose Capati, Randall Bone, and Sean Baldwin, based solely upon the wrongful application of the responsible corporate officer doctrine. As previously briefed, the regional board has no jurisdiction to impose liability based upon legal theories such as the responsible corporate officer doctrine. And despite our prior briefing on this issue, the tentative AC order does nothing to address the question of jurisdiction. As a side note, since I mentioned our briefing, I'd reiterate that we previously requested that our non-confidential briefing and expert reports, including the Rincon report, Tory Walker report, Kermatka and Associates report, be posted for public consumption and review on the regional board website. That request was improperly refused, and the public was denied access to this information. This lack of transparency is unacceptable and unconscionable. Now back to the lack of responsible corporate officer liability. The tentative ACL order also acknowledges that Mr. Capati in particular was merely an employee, as the evidence overwhelmingly showed. He was never a corporate officer of any of the dischargers. And as the board knows, responsible corporate officer liability can only be imposed on corporate officers. And even then, only in very specific circumstances. There's no evidentiary basis for imposing liability on Mr. Capati here. Finally, neither Randall Bowen nor Sean Baldwin was ever a corporate officer of SRCPH Investments LLC, and thus neither can be assigned liability here. Next topic, the tentative order overstates liability as against Sun Ranch and SRCPH. Specifically, the order imposes liability for the entire penalty amount as against both Sun Ranch Capital Partners LLC, whom I'll call Sun Ranch, and SRCPH Investments LLC, whom I'll call SRCPH. This imposition of liability is inconsistent with the evidence. As to Sun Ranch, the tentative ACL order imposes liability against it in particular based upon its statement that Sun Ranch was a so-called LRP for the project. But this ignores the uncontroverted evidence that Sun Ranch conveyed all its property interest in Portola South to SRCPH in July of 2015, before the first violation occurred. So as a matter of law, Sun Ranch could not be the LRP after July 29th, 2015. And given that Sun Ranch was no longer eligible to serve as the LRP after July 29th, 2015, there's no legal basis for imposing civil liabilities for the subsequently occurring violations. As to SRCPH, the tentative order imposes liability on SRCPH for all violations for the entire violation period based upon the statement that SRCPH was the owner of the Portola South project. Again, the uncontroverted evidence in the record shows that SRCPH only owned the property from July 29, 2015 until November 12, 2015, when it conveyed the property to a third-party purchaser. LSOC Portola LLC, who we generally refer to as Land C. Given SRCPH's limited period of ownership that I just mentioned, it was not the owner during the vast majority of the violation period, and certainly could not have owner liability for violations occurring after its ownership. It's worth noting that most of the violations in the tentative order occurred after SRCPH's ownership period concluded. As a result, the tentative AC order substantially overstates liability as against SRCPH. Next topic. As the board likely knows, in accordance with a California Supreme Court decision known as Topanga, the board is required to make findings that, quote, bridge the analytic gap between raw evidence and the ultimate decision or order, close quote. That's language from the Supreme Court's decision in Topanga. And among other things, this requirement that I just mentioned has been interpreted to mean that conclusory findings lacking reference to the administrative record are insufficient. Here, the tentative ACL order violates these important principles repeatedly. A review of the tentative ACL order reveals that there are dozens of substantive conclusions stated without any reference to support in the record. Next, the tentative ACL order is based upon testimony of staff witnesses, both regional board and state board, who lack the necessary expert qualifications to provide testimony. Given that we have briefed this topic somewhat exhaustively, I'll just note that the tentative ACL order relies on improper opinion testimony on expert matters from regional board and state board staff members who clearly and even admittedly lack the requisite expertise to speak on the matters addressed in their testimony. The tentative AC order's reliance on this testimony is in violation of California case law that provides a staff member's opinion does not provide sufficient evidentiary basis for an agency's determination when that determination regards a highly technical matter that requires expert opinion. Here, that principle has been violated. Next, the tentative AC order is not supported by substantial evidence. This is a significant topic that could draw discussion for much more time than I have here today. So what I'll say on this topic is that the AC order's findings generally, as a general principle, are simply not supported by substantial evidence. By way of example, this includes the volume discharge estimate that's relied upon in the order, the scoring of the enforcement policy penalty factors that's provided in the order, and the assignment of liability to non-liable parties that I've discussed earlier. Moving on, the board also improperly overruled evidentiary objections. And as a result, the tentative order is founded upon improper or inadmissible evidence.
Excuse me, Mr. T, we're going to do a time check here. I think that's what we're doing. You have 1 minute left, please. Thank you.
I won't go through all the various objections. The record will stand on that. The last comment is I have, we briefed this extensively. But the AC order, like the ACL complaint originally, violates the enforcement policy's requirement for fair and consistent enforcement. I'll refer to our briefing, refer the board to our prior briefing on that. And given that I'm about to run the clock out, I'd simply like to thank you all for your attention this morning, for your attention during the January hearing. And we hope the board will take our comments seriously and the board will defer action on the tentative AC order so that our concerns can be addressed. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Now, I remember that the prosecution team had time left on their clock, and I suspect you want to use that now.
I'll be very brief because I think a majority of the comments that Mr. T raised are more properly addressed by the advisory team in its counsel to the board members. I will say that Mr. T referred to alleged improper ex parte communications between the prosecution team and the board members and or the advisory team. I'm unaware of any such communications and no specifics were provided. In terms of the due process given to dischargers, I remind the board members and the dischargers that this is not a civil litigation trial and that due process requires an opportunity to be heard in this case, which was unlimited. It took the hearing process from 2020 to 2022, unlimited exhibits and oral testimony. We did not put any limits on staff being deposed. The hearing procedures, he referred to Malaga as an underground regulation. To the contrary, in this matter, the hearing procedures were proposed with the ACLC that was issued in January 2020. With the proposed hearing procedures that Mr. Rosenbaum, Mr. T's co-counsel, objected to and then continued to object to throughout the process. So in terms of the hearing time, the length of briefing, the subjects for briefing, dischargers had an opportunity to argue that before the board and the advisory council, and the advisory council made numerous rulings throughout that two-year process of them being heard. 17 hours over the course of 3 days obviously encompassed some summary testimony, but it also was relied on more than 30 deposition transcripts. In terms of expertise, we've clarified that the board members, both regional and state board, include duties that are not necessarily familiar to lay people, but that these staff employees work with on a daily basis, and it does not require the level of expertise as in a civil trial. And that even if it did, we feel like we could meet that standard. Mr. Elder testified about on-site conditions as opposed to the multiple experts that dischargers proffered, many of whom did not read and review each other's work. So they were independent experts that were put together, selected by counsel, but their conclusions were internally inconsistent. The tentative order relates to Rincon's conclusion and provides findings that Rincon conflated and misapplied some of the enforcement policy factors, especially with regards to deviation from requirement and cleanup and cooperation. I think we looked at all the factors, and in terms of the application for consistency, like I said, we started with San Altos. And I also think that the prosecution team's mission from the beginning was to seek an appropriate penalty. And so it's not a simple rote application of enforcement policy factors. It's an appropriate penalty to this discharger or group of dischargers that conveys the appropriate message. And in this case, there were a number of opportunities for better compliance, such as stop work orders and informal notices of violation from the city of Lake Forest, which were accompanied by $500 and $1,000 fines. Those were not sufficient here. It simply took a multi-year effort to get this party to acknowledge the permit conditions that it had agreed to prior to beginning the project. In terms of substantial evidence, findings related to Topanga, I feel that's more appropriately advisory team's responsibility. But I feel that our process will stand, and I feel that a large majority of the objections are with the incentive of converting this to a civil litigation process, which is inappropriate for the myriad amount of A, either minor penalties, or B, parties who cannot afford that, and that in this case process was met and simply did not result in something favorable to the dischargers.
Thank you. At this time, we'll invite any interested persons being here in this room or virtually on Zoom to add any comments. Do we have any indication of interested persons who wish to comment, clerk? There are none. Okay, there are none. Do the board members have any questions based on the comments that we've received today? I see none. So at this point, I'm sorry.
Excuse me, Chair Cantu. I do have a few questions for Mr. T. During your comments, you made a comment about some ex parte communications that occurred before the board, and but you did not provide any specific examples. And can you clarify what you meant by that?
Yes, I'd be glad to. Thank you. Sorry, like I said, I had to keep my comments to an overview. I knew I was going to run out of time. What I said, and if just to be clear, what I said, there was a concern about a potential ex parte communication, and that was my phrasing of it, and that's because in looking at the hearing transcript, there was interaction between Vice Chair Olson and discharger witness Torrin Snyder, in which Vice Chair Olson asked Mr. Snyder questions during his presentation or following his presentation about certain photographs and the content of those photographs. Mr. Snyder indicated he'd be willing to go back to those photographs and explain the nature of what was depicted, and Vice Chair Olson declined that offer. and said she would simply consult with the prosecution team. Given that that interaction occurred after the prosecution team had completed its presentation, the only, I think, possible manner in which Vice Chair Olson could consult with the prosecution team would be in the form of an ex parte communication. There was no, to my knowledge, I was there, I didn't see any interaction between Vice Chair Olson and the prosecution team following Mr. Snyder's presentation regarding this topic. So it certainly left a question in my mind about whether an improper ex parte communication had occurred, and that's why I noted it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. T. So you noted that Board Member Olson said she might consult with the prosecution team afterwards, but you're not familiar with her or have any specific evidence of her consulting with the prosecution team? Is that correct?
I couldn't possibly have such evidence. I mean, it would have occurred outside of my presence. My concern is that she indicated an intention to have a communication, and the only manner in which that communication could have occurred is through an ex parte communication, because the prosecution team had completed its presentation at that time. So I obviously I would not be privy to whatever ex parte communications occurred. That's the nature of ex parte communications. And I am just noting that there was this interaction. It's clear on the record. And so I invite you to take a look at the transcript to get the specific language that was used.
Thank you, Mr. T.
Thank you.
Anything else?
I'd like to just ask Board Member Olson to clarify whether she had any communications with the prosecution team.
I had no direct communication with the prosecution team. I probably misspoke in terms, because we did have the file ourselves to
thank
go
you.
Back and review.
Thank you, Board Member Olson. And when you said you misspoke, did you mean you misspoke and meant to say you would communicate with the advisory team instead?
I think I probably was referring to going back and looking at the material itself.
Okay, thank you for clarifying. I also, Mr. T, I also have some further questions for you. You made some comments about that the board might be biased based on some of the statements made during the hearing. Could you clarify what you meant by that?
Of course, I'd be glad to. What I referred to, I think, in my comments was a series of comments that were interjected by Board Member Barbanel during the first day of the hearing. Most of it occurred, I believe, during my opening remarks. Some of it, I believe, during the prosecution team's opening remarks. All of it occurred before the first witness had been presented for testimony. And there were just a series of comments from Board Member Barbanel indicating a level of prejudgment about matters and an apparent desire to impose liability in excess of the recommended liability amount, and also just an indication that the recommended penalty amount was too low. All of that, especially given that it was presented by him before any witnesses had actually testified in the three-day hearing, is cause for concern. And it did suggest, in my view, suggested there was prejudgment and bias involved.
Thank you, Mr. T. I will note that the record for the... that the board members did have access to the evidence and the record in this matter prior to the hearing and was able to review some of the materials prior to the hearing. So we will go back and look at the transcript.
Can I respond to that, sir?
Yes.
I understand there is a fair amount of material submitted before the hearing, but as in any kind of proceeding, whether it's administrative or civil, decision makers should avoid prejudgment until all of the evidence is presented. In this case, none of the live witness testimony, some of the most powerful testimony to be presented, had been put before the board. So while I understand some evidence had been presented, I still believe it's disconcerting that board members would express a prejudgment of the issues before all of the evidence was before them. So that's all I want to note. Thank you.
Mr. T, during your comments, you also stated that some board members were not present during portions of the hearing. Can you clarify that?
Yes, I don't have, I don't have the names, but my recollection and my notes reflected that on day three of the hearing, the final day of the three-day hearing, that two board members were not present during parts of the testimony presented by the discharger and also closing presentation that I presented at that time. And I think the hearing transcript reflects this, sir.
Thank you, Mr. T. I will note that the record and the hearing transcript was made available to the board members so that they could review the portions that they were not able to attend.
And Chair Cantu, if I could please, as your executive officer and head of the advisory team, I will confirm for Mr. T and members of the public that board members Warren and board member Barbadell both reviewed and listened to the recordings and were able to participate in the board's deliberations and consideration of this matter in its totality.
Sorry, this is board member Warren. I would clarify, I read the transcript. I didn't listen to the recording.
Thank you. Anything else?
One additional comment about the hearing procedures. Mr. T made some comments that the hearing procedures might be an underground regulation pursuant to the Malaga case. I will note that the hearing procedures were initially proposed by the prosecution team as part of the package for the administrative civil liability complaint. There was an opportunity to provide comments on the hearing procedures. And then the advisory team issued revised hearing procedures afterwards. The hearing procedures were revised several times, considering issues related to the COVID-19 pandemic and other procedural matters to account for the extended delays related to COVID. And that's it. Thank you.
Thank you. So at this point, I'll entertain a motion to approve tentative order, Regional Board 9, 2022-0094.
All right, before we do that, do we need to, the typographical errors that were pointed out?
Oh, yes.
Do we need to address that?
Yes, if you know, I have not had a time to review those typos, so maybe if we could take a 5 or 10 minute break so that the advisory team can just review and clarify as necessary.
Very good.
We can come back.
We'll take a 5 minute break in terms of 5 minutes and we'll return. Thank you. Thank you.
thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to review the typos brought up by the prosecution team. I'll note that the dischargers did not make any objections to these typos. In the tentative order on page 16 in footnote 9, there is a pronoun missing, and there's a sentence that said, that should say, man affirmed that he. So the next typo in the tentative order on page 51, under the section for January 8th, 2016, the advisory team agrees that a citation should be added to the end of that paragraph, citing to prosecution team exhibit 425. In attachment number one, on page 37, at the end of the first paragraph on that page, in the last sentence, there is a reference to the ACLC report, and the prosecution or the advisory team agrees that that should say the RINCON ACLC report. And on page 45, under step number five of the calculation for November 2015 through the March 2016 violations, that should say, there is a one missing, so it should be 116,025. And so with those four corrections, we recommend that the board adopt with those four corrections.
Thank you. That's consistent with what we heard before. At this point, again, I'll entertain a motion from our board to adopt the tentative order, Regional Board 9, 2022-0094, as corrected and detailed immediately before us, four different corrections. Do I have a motion?
I would like to so move.
Thank you. Is there a second?
I'll second.
Thank you. Any discussion? Will the clerk please call the roll?
Mr. Anderson?
Aye.
Ms. Blair?
Yes.
Dr. Olson?
Aye.
Mr. Strawn?
Aye.
Ms. Warren?
Aye.
Chair Cantu?
Aye. Motion carries. Thank you. At this point, we're on item number five, board member requests for future agenda items. Do we have any board member requests for future agenda items at this time? Hearing none, we will adjourn to a closed session. Mr. Vu, will you please give a brief description of our work in closed session?
Thank you, Chair Cantu. I'd like to ask Council Alex Sauerwein to announce the closed session items for today.
Very good.
The board will discuss items 6J and 6K, which are the US IBWC matters. Board member Henry Abernall will join the closed session virtually.
Thank you very much. Good to be back in the building. We will be dark next at this time next month, but we look forward to seeing people in September in Temecula or August. I'm sorry, I'm missing my month here.
We will meet again in August here and then in September in Temecula.
That's right. So let me be clear. We won't see you in July, but we will be back here in August. And in September, we'll be in Temecula at Rancho California Water District. Thank you.